What does it take to lose your airplane? Not mechanically, not the prop strike, not the failed annual, not the engine that finally gives up. I mean, legally. What does it take for a federal agent to walk up to your hangar, attach a notice to the door, and tell you that everything inside is no longer yours? The answer is less than most pilots think, and right now a case that AveWeb has been tracking is heading to the United States Supreme Court. The justices are going to decide exactly how much the Constitution protects aircraft owners when the government decides your airplane is a forfeiture target. I'm Tower on ATIS from Radio Hangar. We are going into the legal weeds today, and you should stay with me, because this one is worth understanding. Today's segment is brought to you by AviationSoul.com, aviation challenge coins built to mark the milestones, discipline, and pride behind every step in flight. From first solo to airline transport pilot, every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. Civil asset forfeiture is one of the most misunderstood legal mechanisms in American law, and it reaches into aviation more than most pilots realize. Here is the baseline. Civil asset forfeiture is a legal process by which the government seizes property it claims is connected to a crime. The critical distinction is that this is civil forfeiture, not criminal forfeiture. Criminal forfeiture happens after a conviction. The government proves you committed a crime, you are found guilty. And part of the sentence is losing property used in or gained from that crime. Intuitive. Understandable. Civil forfeiture works differently. The government does not need a conviction. In many cases, it does not even need to charge you with anything. It files suit against the property itself, which is why you see forfeiture cases with names like United States versus one aircraft with a specific registration number. The thing is the defendant, and once the government files, you're the one who has to appear and prove why you should get the property back. The burden of proof in a civil forfeiture case is considerably lower than in a criminal case. The government has to show the property is more likely than not connected to criminal activity. That preponderance standard, a little better than 50-50, is all it takes to initiate proceedings. And then you are fighting a legal action to reclaim what was yours. That fight costs money. It costs time, and while you're fighting, your aircraft is sitting in federal custody, maybe in a secured facility, maybe on an open ramp somewhere. The battery is discharging, the static ports are uncovered, the engine is not being run. If the aircraft spends a winter outside in a climate with freeze-thaw cycles, you have potential airframe concerns. By the time some pilots win their aircraft back, what they receive is something that needs a significant inspection before it can fly again, and in some cases, something that requires expensive repairs. The legal victory does not always come with a usable airplane. This mechanism was not designed with general aviation in mind, but it was applied to aviation aggressively during the drug enforcement campaigns of the 1980s. The southern border routes, the Gulf Coast corridors, the Caribbean approaches, all of them were running narcotics by air. Cessna Skymasters, Piper Navajos, Aero Commanders, twins that could carry useful loads over meaningful distances. The government correctly identified aviation as a primary distribution method for cocaine and marijuana, and it went after aircraft accordingly. Many of those seizures were entirely justified. An aircraft with concealed compartments, no legitimate cargo documentation, and an inbound track from outside the country is not a difficult call. Take the airplane, remove a tool from a trafficking operation. No reasonable person argues against that. The problem has always been the edges. The aircraft owners who had no meaningful connection to what triggered the seizure. There are documented cases where aircraft owners lost their planes because of someone else's actions. Owners whose airplane was chartered by a client who turned out to be moving money or drugs. Owners whose plane was borrowed by someone who was not forthcoming about their intentions. Owners whose aircraft was stolen, used for a flight connected to criminal activity, and returned without the owner ever knowing, until agents arrived. In each of those situations, the owner ends up in the same position, retaining attorneys, contesting the seizure, and waiting years for any kind of resolution. Congress attempted to address some of this with the Civil Asset Forfeiture Reform Act of 2000. That legislation created a clearer innocent owner defense, shifted some burdens of proof, and established a legal aid provision for people who cannot afford to contest a forfeiture on their own. Attorney fees recoverable by prevailing owners were capped, and many aviation attorneys have found that cap inadequate relative to what the litigation actually costs. The reform helped at the margins, but it was not a complete fix. Some federal statutes used to seize aircraft fall outside the Reform Act's framework entirely. Certain customs violations, specific narcotic statutes, money laundering provisions, these can invoke procedural rules where the Reform Act's protections do not fully apply. The reform closed some gaps and left others open. And so the constitutional backstop in many forfeiture cases has been the Eighth Amendment. The Eighth Amendment to the United States Constitution prohibits excessive bail, excessive fines, and cruel and unusual punishments. The excessive fines clause is the relevant provision when we talk about forfeiture. The argument that aviation attorneys and property rights advocates have long made is that civil forfeiture operates as a fine. The government takes something of value as a consequence of your alleged connection to wrongdoing. If the amount taken is grossly disproportionate to the underlying conduct, the Constitution should prohibit it. This argument gained major legal footing in 2019 with the Supreme Court's decision in Timms versus Indiana. Tyson Timms had been convicted in Indiana on drug-related charges. His criminal sentence was home detention and probation. Indiana separately sought to forfeit his Land Rover, valued at roughly $42,000. The maximum fine available under the statute for the underlying offense was $10,000. The state wanted to take a vehicle worth more than four times the maximum available penalty. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously that the Eighth Amendment's excessive fines clause is incorporated against the states through the 14th Amendment. State and local governments are bound by it, just as the federal government is. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg wrote the majority opinion, tracing the prohibition against excessive fines back to Magna Carta and through eight centuries of Anglo-American legal tradition. The protection, the court held, is fundamental, rooted deeply enough in history and legal practice that it qualifies as one of the core protections the Constitution extends to everyone in every state. Timms versus Indiana was a landmark decision, but it left a critical question unanswered. How do you measure whether a forfeiture is excessive? The constitutional standard established by prior case law is gross disproportionality. The forfeiture must not be grossly disproportionate to the gravity of the offense, but grossly disproportionate compared to what do you do? Compare the value of the seized property to the maximum statutory fine for the underlying offense? Do you compare it to the harm actually caused by the conduct? Do you look at the level of the person's culpability? Do you apply a multi-factor balancing test that weighs several of these considerations at once? Courts have answered that question differently depending on where you file. Some circuits use a fairly direct ratio analysis. Others apply a more flexible balancing approach that gives judges broader discretion within the same circuit. Different district courts have reached different conclusions applying the nominally same standard. The practical result is this: two aircraft owners facing the identical factual situation with identical aircraft of identical value, seized under identical statutes for identical alleged conduct, could receive meaningfully different constitutional protection based purely on geography, not because the facts differ. Because the measuring stick applied differs depending on where the case is filed and which court hears it. That is the specific problem the new Supreme Court case is asking the court to fix. As reported by AveWeb, the case presents the question of how courts should measure whether a forfeiture violates the Eighth Amendment. The court has the opportunity to lay down a uniform binding standard applicable in every federal court in the country. The aircraft in this case was seized by the government. The owner has challenged that seizure on Eighth Amendment grounds, arguing the forfeiture is grossly disproportionate to the underlying conduct. The case worked through the lower courts and is now before the justices. Here's what you need to know if you own an aircraft. The value of the constitutional protection depends entirely on the standard applied. If the Supreme Court establishes a strong proportionality rule, something anchored to a clear relationship between the value of the seized asset and the maximum available fine or the actual harm caused, aircraft owners gain a more predictable and more protective floor. An aircraft worth considerably more than the maximum penalty for the triggering conduct would have a substantial constitutional argument. If the court adopts a loose multi-factor standard, the protection remains but becomes harder to invoke reliably. More judicial discretion means more variable outcomes. You might prevail with one judge and lose with another on identical facts. A middle ground outcome. A primary ratio test with secondary factors courts can weigh would provide more consistency than currently exists without drawing a rigid bright line that either side would consider a complete victory. This matters differently at different price points, and I want to be specific about that. A used Cessna 172 in flyable condition is selling in today's market for $80,000 to over $100,000 depending on the panel and airframe time. A Piper Comanche, a Mooney Ovation, a Cirrus SR-22, all of them represent assets in ranges that make the proportionality question very real if the underlying conduct that triggered a seizure would have resulted in a civil penalty measured in the thousands. The arithmetic is not subtle, and the arithmetic is exactly what some courts are using, while other courts are using something else entirely. Oral arguments have not been scheduled as of this recording, and the briefing process is ongoing. The court's term runs into June, so a decision could come before summer or carry into the following term. This case is worth watching. For pilots, the practical message is not to let this change your pre-flight routine. Most aircraft owners will never face a forfeiture proceeding, but the legal landscape matters, and understanding it is worth the time. Forfeiture statutes reach broadly. The connection required between the aircraft and the alleged criminal activity has been interpreted expansively in some jurisdictions. If you rent your aircraft, charter it, operate it under a flying club arrangement, or regularly allow someone else access to it, you have some exposure, however small. Know who is using your airplane and under what circumstances. If you ever receive a forfeiture notice, act immediately. The deadlines for contesting are short, and missing them can result in a default judgment without a hearing. The Aircraft Owners and Pilots Association has legal services resources for members, and an aviation attorney who specializes in forfeiture defense is the right call from the moment you receive any government notice referencing your aircraft. The Supreme Court hearing this case is a chance for some clarity on a question that has been inconsistently answered for years. Whether that clarity runs toward aircraft owners or toward the government, at least we will have a defined rule. And knowing the rules matters, whether you're flying an approach or navigating a legal system. AVWeb has been following this case and is the source for today's coverage. You can track the docket publicly as briefing continues. More at RadioHangar.com. I'm Tower. Stay legal out there and know what is protecting you before you need it.